Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 5, Herodotus. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 72, April 2004. From the 2004 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser. Read by Dan Adams. This is my 72nd monthly teaching letter and completes my 6th year of publication. As this teaching letter is a continuation of lesson number 71, you may not fully comprehend the subject matter presented herein until you do read it. The object of these lessons is to show Herodotus was an anointed witness to the fulfillment of biblical prophecy concerning the whereabouts of the lost tribes at his time. Thus, Herodotus' witness becomes a vital factor to the awakening of the true Israelites of today. Without his witness, we might never have come to a realization of who we are, being Yahweh's covenant people. I then quoted quite a lengthy passage from The World of Herodotus by Aubrey de Selincourt, chapters 19 and 20. For other references, check The Post-Captivity Names of Israel, by William Pascoe Gord, Chapter 7, pages 76 through 80, A History of Greece by J.B. Burry, pages 228 through 229, and A History of the Greek City-States by Raphael Seeley, page 173. Also see The Smithsonian, March 2000, pages 88 through 93. Later in this series on Herodotus, I will show how the archaeologist Spade is vindicating his writings. Once we have observed Herodotus' writings and compare them with what they have found on the Scythians in archaeology, it will build our confidence to a high level of regard for them. The whole idea is to present Herodotus' writings on the Scythians from an Israel identity perspective, rather than secular history. Review of Herodotus' writings on the Scythians. We might start our story about Herodotus' writings concerning the Scythians with Cyrus II, the Great, first king of Persia. The Persians were predominantly Elamites of the house of Shem. The Medes, on the other hand, were descendants of Japheth, and they eventually allied themselves with the Elamite Persians, forming the great Medo-Persian Empire. It was a Shemitic-Japhetic partnership. While Cyrus II was considered my Yahweh shepherd at Isaiah 44:28, nevertheless, Cyrus was an empire builder. In building his empire, he had to conquer many peoples and ethnic groups. And while the Persians and Medes were both white people, the rest of the conquered people were not necessarily so. Cyrus was busy organizing his new won territories into satraps. One of the peoples he tangled with were the Massagetae. In that encounter, Cyrus II was killed by the Massagetae, and Cambyses, his son, recovered his body. Cyrus II, in his effort to expand his empire too far, made the fatal mistake of combating with Yahweh's battle axe and weapons of war, Jeremiah 51:20. Collier's Encyclopedia has Cyrus' death at 530 BC. In fact, Herodotus testifies of the Persian campaign against the Massagetae and Cyrus' death at 1:201 through 2:14. If you have a copy of Herodotus, the Histories, read it for yourself. And while you are reading it, be sure to read 1:215 also, as it speaks of the battle axes of the Massagetae. This is just one more significant reason that every serious Bible student should have and study Herodotus' writings. At Herodotus 1:201, it describes Cyrus' endeavor to conquer the Massagetae. By many regarded as a Scythian race, 1:202 describes the Araxes River, which Rawlinson notes. The geographical knowledge of Herodotus seems to be nowhere so much at fault as in his account of this river. He appears to have confused together the information which had reached him concerning two or three distinct streams, Note that Herodotus is writing of events 100 years before his time in a place he never visited. At 1, 203 and 204, Herodotus describes the Caspian Sea, the Araxes River, which empties into it from the west, and the Caucasus Mountains, which bind the Caspian there. This is the land Herodotus places the Massagetae in. 1-215, Herodotus describes the Massagetae in their dress and mode of living. They resemble the Scythians, and as he says later, that the Scythians carry their favorite weapon is the battle axe. End quote. This Araxes River, circa 530 BC, where Cyrus II invades the Scythians, is the ancient boundary between Armenia, but this section lies in Azerbaijan today, and Media, currently northwest Iran. Diodorus Siculus says of the Scythians at 248. But now in turn we shall discuss the Scythians, who inhabit the country bordering upon India. This people originally possessed little territory, but later as they gradually increased in power, they seized much territory by reason of their deeds of might and their bravery, and advanced their nation to great leadership and renown. At first, then, they dwelt on the Araxes River, altogether few in number and despised because of their lack of renown. But since one of their early kings was warlike and of unusual skill as a general, they acquired territory in the mountains as far as the Caucasus and in the steppes along the ocean and Lake Maetos, the Sea of Azov today, and the rest of that country as far as the Tanais River. But some time later the descendants of these kings subdued much of the territory beyond the Tanais River as far as Thrace, for this people increased to great strength and had notable kings, one of whom gave his name to the Sakae, another to the Massagetae, another to the Arimapsi, and several other tribes received their names in like manner. End quote. So while Diodorus describes the naming of the various related Scythian tribes fancifully, he surely is accurate in the description of the origins and growth of these people, and corroborates Herodotus concerning their relationship and location. Strabo, the geographer, writing of these peoples a short time, maybe 75 years after Diodorus, corroborates the statements of Herodotus and Diodorus with the following. At Strabo 7:3-9, the Sakae are of Scythian stock. Herodotus says at 7:64 that of the Scythians, the Persians called them Sakae, since that is the name which they gave to all Scythians. End quote. 11:33, the Iberians of the Caucasus are both neighbors and kinsmen of the Scythians and Sarmatians, with whom they assemble whenever anything alarming occurs. Note that anciently there were two lands named Iberia. The one, the peninsula later known as Spain, settled by Hebrew, Eber, Israelite Phoenicians, and the other adjacent to the Caucasus Mountains, settled by Hebrew, Israelite, Scythians. 11:62, Sarmatians. Scythians dwell between the Tanais and Caspian Sea. All the people toward the north were, by ancient Greek historians, given the general name Scythians, or Celtoscythians. Note that to Strabo, Herodotus would surely be a most ancient Greek historian. 11:82, the Dai, Massagetae, and Sakae are Scythians, and the inhabitants of Bactriana and Sogdiana, if not Scythians themselves, are ruled over by Scythians. The Asii, Tocharians, and Sacaruli appear to be Scythians. 11:84, Sakasine, a district in Armenia, was so named for the Sakae who dwelt there. So with these statements of Strabo, those of Herodotus and Diodorus Siculus, all fully corroborating each other, the later historians are only clarifying and more fully expounding the earlier. Where Herodotus tells us that the Scythians conquered all of Asia, at 1:104, Strabo relates that in ancient times, Greater Armenia ruled the whole of Asia. 11:13:5. Yet both men are correct, for Diodorus Siculus tells us that the Scythians' origins in Armenia itself. 2:43. Note that while Strabo calls the Sarmatians and Daeae both Scythian, and while surely they are of the same Adamic stock and have similar customs, Diodorus Siculus at 2:43:6 tells us that the Sarmatians originated as a colony of Medes along the Tanais, while Herodotus at 1:125 lists Daans as a nomadic Persian tribe. Speaking in strictly geographic terms, Strabo should be forgiven. To understand Herodotus and the Scythian connection, one must know that the first four kings of Persia were Cyrus II, Cambyses, son of Cyrus II, Smerdis the Impostor, and Darius Hystaspes. Now, when Darius Hystaspes came to the Persian throne, he made the same mistake of trying to conquer the Scythians as Cyrus II had ill-conceived. While the Medes and Persians were ferocious fighters, they were no match for the Scythian Israelites. To give a good example, at the time Cyrus II was campaigning against the Massagetae had a female leader by the name of Queen Thomyris, whose husband had previously died, Herodotus 1:205 and 206. So Cyrus II the Great was outwitted by an Israelite Scythian woman. Most of Herodotus' fourth book concerns the Scythians and this invasion by Darius against them. This invasion was against the Scythians north of Thrace, for Darius is described as invading that land and bridging the Ister, the Danube, to cross into Scythia. Herodotus actually visited and stayed among the Scythians in this region for quite some time, during which he compiled the material for his fourth book. At Herodotus 4:5, according to the account which the Scythians themselves give, they are the youngest of all nations. And while he goes on here to report a fantastic tale of their origins, this account is not in disagreement with that of Diodorus cited above. 4:11, Herodotus describes these as having warred with the Massagetae, as Saxon tribes fought each other even throughout modern history, and therefore quitted their homes, crossed the Araxes, and entered the land of Cimmeria, for the land which is now inhabited by the Scyths was formerly the country of the Cimmerians. End quote. Here Rawlinson conjectures that this Araxes, surely not the former river in Armenia, may be the Volga. Either the Volga or the Don, called the Tanais by the Greeks, must be the river meant here, since the country of the Cimmerians is likely the Crimea, west of the Don and the Sea of Azov, which it empties into. The location of the Scythians here is corroborated by Diodorus Siculus, mentioned above, as is the Scythian presence to the north of Thrace. 4:48, Herodotus describes the Ister, the Danube, and calls all of the rivers which feed the Ister from the north genuine Scythian rivers. At 4:49, Herodotus surely knew the extent of the Danube, where he says, "For the Ister flows through the whole extent of Europe, rising in the country of the Celts," by which he must mean the Rhineland, and calls that country the most westerly of all the nations of Europe, excepting the Kynecians. Of the Kynecians, or Kynesians, at Herodotus 2:33, Rawlinson states, "are a nation of whom nothing is known but their abode from very ancient times at the extreme southwest of Europe. For there," Herodotus states, "the Celts live beyond the Pillars of Hercules and border on the Kynesians, who dwell at the extreme west of Europe." While Herodotus calls the rest of Europe north of the Ister an interminable wilderness, 5:9, we must turn later to Strabo in order to find that the Germans who inhabit this area and settled in Herodotus' time are truly Celts and Scythians, that all are kinsmen and all crossed west from Asia. While Strabo does not contradict Herodotus, he surely does expand upon the early testimony of Herodotus and corroborates him fully. To Strabo, Celtica is all the land from the Pyrenees to the Rhine. 497. Here Darius is said to have crossed the Ister from Thrace. After subduing the Gatae and other inhabitants of the land, embarking upon his failed attempt to conquer the Scythians. Throughout these chapters, Herodotus discusses many circumstances of the Scythians which illustrate the words of the Hebrew prophets and the destiny of the children of Israel, all of which will be discussed later. At 764, Herodotus discusses the Scythians who, much later, under Xerxes, were part of the Persian army that invaded Greece. While it is evident from Strabo and Diodorus that these Scythians are indeed related to those of Europe and the area around Caucasus, as can be determined from some of the passages already mentioned, among others, it is apparent that certain tribes or divisions of these eastern Scythians were under the yoke of the Persian Empire. The Scythians listed here by Herodotus, also called Sakae, and more specifically, Amergian Scythians, a geographical designation, as Rawlinson explains, are listed in company with the Bactrians. The Caspians are mentioned at 767 and then at 786. Both Bactrians and Caspians are mentioned together. We have seen in Strabo 11.8.2 a relationship between the Scythian and Bactrian and Caspiana is a region bordering the north bank of the Araxes River where it empties into the Caspian Sea. The north and west of Caspiana are bordered by Armenia, Iberia, and Albania, all occupied by people related, as told by Strabo, at his time to the Scythians. Caspiana must be, as Dr. George Moore agrees in his The Lost Tribes and the Saxons of the East and the Saxons of the West, the district mentioned at Ezra 8:17, Caspia, to which Ezra sent for Levites to come to Jerusalem after the rebuilding of the temple. All of this, as we will see later, is instrumental in the understanding of a great portion of the Hebrew prophets. From the sources I cited, we learn that the Scythians were a very adaptable people. While some indicate they were always on the move, living entirely off their animals and wildlife, at other times we are told they were an agricultural people. We find the Scythians were both exporters and importers of great quantities of commodities. It is obvious that our people have the intuitive ability to adjust to almost any adverse situation, a built-in self-sufficient skill to survive under conditions that the other races would fail. And to survive, our people had to be the greatest fighters the world has ever known, in every age. And while our people are naturally vicious fighters, on the other hand, we have the ability to be highly refined and cultured in manners and protocol. So we shouldn't be surprised when Herodotus gives us instances which might seem to be in conflict. We are told that Herodotus didn't admire the Scythians, but at the same time he highly respected them for their ability of self-preservation. Herodotus was fascinated by how the Scythians could defend themselves against almost any destructive or hostile force, that the Scythians were the masters of almost any situation. We should highly respect Herodotus for these observations of our people and for his writing them down for our posterity. Herodotus himself had a more cultured environment and would have had a natural repulsiveness for the unrefined. Selinko notices that the Scythians had a hatred and suspicion of foreigners. We need some of that very same kind of thing today. We can be thankful to Herodotus for recording the outcome of the conflict between Darius and the Scythian Israelites for our benefit. All the while, Yahweh had his man in Herodotus writing it all down for our knowledge today. There are sundry publications quoting Herodotus on many historical subjects, but there is no other more important than the Israel Identity Message to have his records, If you don't have a copy of Herodotus' Histories in your library, you need to do so as soon as possible. There is no other period in history when Herodotus' writings are more valuable and needed than at our present time. Inasmuch as Herodotus has borne witness concerning the Scythian Israelites, we really need to know more about him. So we then ask the question, just who was Herodotus? At the beginning of lesson number 71, I gave an abbreviated, concise description of his life. We know he was a Greek, but was he a Macedonian Greek, an Athenian Greek, or a Dorian Greek? It is insufficient just to call him a Greek. I will repeat a quote from lesson number 71 from the book The World of Herodotus by Aubrey de Selincourt under Biographical, page 28. Little is known of Herodotus' life. His birthplace was Halicarnassus, the modern Bodrum, originally a Carian town on the southwest coast of Asia Minor. It was later occupied by Dorian immigrants from Troezene and became in time like the other Greek settlements on the eastern coast of the Aegean, end quote. This is evidence that Herodotus was a Dorian Greek. We can be quite sure of this as the Greeks lived closely with their kin. On pages 76 and 77, Selincourt says, "But their power was destined to be broken by another Greek-speaking people, the Dorians, who about the year 1100 BC, nearly a century after the traditional date of the Siege of Troy, came with their iron weapons in hordes and carried all before them. This was not a peaceful infiltration like that of their predecessors, but an invasion and a conquest. Unlike the Achaeans, who adopted as their own much of what they found in their new home, the Dorians were destroyers. Their coming brought a period of great confusion as they poured over central Greece and into the Peloponnese. Tribes and communities were reduced to serfdom or swept away. Over a course of two centuries and more, there was a continuous movement of peoples before the pressure of the invaders. The Dorians were a barbarous and virile race, and it took them a long time to learn civilized ways. Some of them, one is tempted to think, never did. For in the years to come, the greatest of the Dorian towns was Sparta. And it is not easy to associate the idea of civilized ways with that profoundly interesting but hateful place." Here we say that Selincourt parrots the prevailing sentiment that Sparta and the Spartans were somehow evil, or as running counter to the universalizing tendencies in Western history always associated with civilization, the broad way that leads to destruction. Continuing with Selincourt, "An important result of the Dorian invasion and the spreading of the Dorian tribes over a large part of the mainland of Greece, and of the shifting of peoples consequent upon it, was the colonization by Greeks of the coast of Asia Minor and of Cyprus and the Aegean Islands. The movement of colonization had begun before the Dorian invasion, but it was now greatly accelerated. The Achaeans, with their kinsmen the Aeolian Greeks, were the first to seek new homes in the kindlier land of Asia and in the offshore island of Lesbos. Their settlements were mainly on the Mysian coast, extending as far south as Old Smyrna, and they were followed by Ionian venturers who settled to the southward as far as Miletus. Lastly, the Dorians themselves joined in the search for new lands, built settlements in the islands of Kos, Cnidus, and Rhodes, and continued the line of Greek coastal towns to the borders of Lycia." End quote. On pages 117 and 118, Selincourt continues, "The Spartans were a Dorian people, and the Dorians, far back at the beginning of things, had fought their way into the Peloponnese, where they had wrested the land from the original inhabitants. Probably they had fighting in their blood more than the other branches of the Greek peoples, and certainly the Spartans, once they were settled as masters of the greater part of the Peloponnese, were compelled to maintain their position amongst the conquered population by force and the threat of force. Sparta itself was a small community, little more, indeed, than a collection of villages. In it lived the true-born Spartan nobility, perhaps 8,000 or 9,000 of them, while everyone else on the scattered farms of the fertile plain of Lacedaemon had lost even their names. They were the Perioeci, the dwellers around, or else the Helots, the Spartan slaves. End quote. Again on page 132, Selincourt says, Sicyon, neighbor to Corinth, was a Dorian state of great antiquity originally founded by Dorians from Argos. After following the pattern of development common to most Greek communities, she fell about the middle of the 7th century BC under the tyranny of a certain Orthagoras, whose dynasty lasted for nearly 100 years. End quote. On page 259, Selincourt comments, for a long time, the Aegintians, a Dorian people, had been a prosperous mercantile community. They were amongst the first of the Greeks to issue a coinage early in the 7th century BC, and the Aegintian silver turtles remained the standard coinage of the Peloponnese for 200 years. The island traded freely with Egypt, and in the reign of Amasis, from 569 to 526 BC, built its own shrine at Naucratis, the trading post at the mouth of the Nile. End quote. You may be wondering why all of this history of the Dorian Greeks is so important. It is significant, as the Dorian Greeks were the people Paul addressed in 1 and 2 Corinthians. How many times have you read 1 and 2 Corinthians and were never aware of that fact? I'm sure after learning this Dorian history, you will never look at 1 and 2 Corinthians in the same light again. Add to that, that Herodotus was very likely a Dorian Greek, and we'll have to take an entirely fresh look at Herodotus. Lacedaemonians of post-Dorian conquest were called Dorian Greeks. From Josephus 12:4, 10, and 11, we read, at this time, Seleucus, who was called Soter, reigned over Asia, being the son of Antiochus the Great, and now Hyrcanus' father, Joseph, died. He was a good man and of great magnanimity, and brought the Judeans out of a state of poverty and meanness to one that was more splendid. He retained the farm of the taxes of Syria and Phoenicia and Samaria 22 years. His uncle also, Onias, died about this time and left the high priesthood to his son Simon. And when he was dead, Onias, his son, succeeded him in that dignity. To him it was that Areus, king of the Lacedaemonians, sent an embassy with an epistle, the copy whereof follows. Areus, king of the Lacedaemonians, to Onias sendeth greeting. We have met with a certain writing whereby we have discovered that both the Judeans and the Lacedaemonians are of one stock, and are derived from the kindred of Abraham. It is but just, therefore, that you, who are our brethren, should send to us about any of your concerns as you please. We will also do the same thing, and esteem your concerns as our own, and will look upon our concerns as in common with yours. Demotolis, who brings you this letter, will bring your answer back to us. This letter is foursquare, and the seal is an eagle, with a dragon in its claws. And these were the contents of the epistle which were sent from the king of the Lacedaemonians. End quote. You will notice that the seal is an eagle with a dragon in its claws, which is the seal of Israel's seed against the dragon seed. A lot of people see the eagle, but cannot observe the dragon in his claws. The Lacedaemonians spoken of here are Dorian Greeks, of which Herodotus was akin. We don't have to guess at this, for we know that the Corinthians were Dorian Greeks, and were a part of the lost children of Israel. Paul indicates such with certainty at 1 Corinthians 10, that their fathers were with Moses in the Exodus. The history of the Greek city-states, or telling them that they had descended from the 12 tribes. There is a footnote here based upon the suppositions of Grotius, Clement, and others, all of whom are writing in blindness as to the identification of the Israelites, imagining some other connection between the Dorians and Judeans, rather than seeing that the Dorians themselves are sprung from an early colony of Israelites. From Josephus 13:5-8, He enjoyed the same ambassadors that, as they came back, they should go to the Spartans and put them in mind of their friendship and kindred. So when the ambassadors came to Rome, they went into their senate and said that they were commanded by Jonathan their high priest to say how he had sent them to confirm their friendship. The senate then confirmed what had been formally decreed concerning their friendship with the Judeans, and gave them letters to carry to all the kings of Asia and Europe, and to the governors of the cities, that they might safely conduct them to their own country. Accordingly, as they returned, they came to Sparta and delivered the epistle which they had received of Jonathan to them, a copy of which here follows. Jonathan, the high priest of the Judean nation, and the senate and body of the people of the Judeans, to the Ephori and senate and body of the people of the Lacedaemonians, send greeting. If you be well, and both your public and private affairs be agreeable in your mind, it is according to our wishes. We are well also. When in former times an epistle was brought to Onias, who was then our high priest, from Areus, who at that time was your king, by Demotilus, concerning the kindred that was between us and you, a copy of which is here subjoined, we both joyfully received the epistle and were well pleased with Demotilus and Areus, although we did not need such a demonstration, because we were well satisfied about it from the sacred writings. Yet did not we think fit first to begin the claim of this relation to you, lest we should seem too early in taking to ourselves the glory which is now given us by you. It is a long time since this relation of ours to you hath been renewed. And when we upon holy and festival days offer sacrifices to God, we pray to him for your preservation and victory. As to ourselves, although we have had many wars that have compassed us about, by reason of the covetousness of our neighbors, yet did not we determine to be troublesome either to you or to others that were related to us. End quote. Footnote at page 272. This clause is otherwise rendered in the first book of Maccabees 12:9. For that we have the holy books of Scripture in our hands to comfort us. The Hebrew Aramaic maybe, original being lost, we cannot certainly judge which was the truest version. Only the coherence favors Josephus. We will now put the icing on the cake concerning the Dorian Greeks by quoting from 1 Maccabees 12, 17 through 23. We commanded them also to go unto you, and to salute you, and to deliver you our letters concerning the renewing of our brotherhood. Wherefore now we should do well to give us an answer thereto. And this is the copy of the letters which Onias sent. Areus, king of the Lacedaemonians, to Onias the high priest, greeting. It is found in writing that the Lacedaemonians and Judeans are brothers, and that they are of the stock of Abraham. Now therefore, since this has come to our knowledge, ye shall do well to write unto us of your prosperity. We do write back again to you that your cattle and goods are ours, and ours are yours. We do command, therefore, our ambassadors to make report unto you on this wise. If there was any question who Herodotus was, and who the Dorian Greeks were, there should be little question now. I will continue my quest on this subject until I can present it in the proper manner. The word Lacedaemonians, a district named before the Dorian conquest, can also be found at 1 Maccabees 12, 2, 5, 21, 14 through 20, 23, 15 through 23, and 2 Maccabees 5, 9. All these refer to Sparta and the Dorian Greeks. The following is from the Zondervan Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, Volume 3, page 850. Lacedaemonian, inhabitants of Lacedaemon, more commonly called Sparta in southern Greece. Friend relations between Sparta and the Judeans began early in the 3rd century BC when Arius, from 309 to 265, was king, and Onias was high priest, from 320 to 290 in Jerusalem. In 168 BC, Jason the high priest, after his unsuccessful attempt to seize Jerusalem, was forced to flee and went to Sparta with the idea of finding shelter there among kinsfolk. 2 Maccabees 5:9. This implies the existence of a Judean colony in Sparta during the 2nd century. In about 146 BC, Jonathan wrote to the Spartans requesting renewal of the ancient friendship, 1 Maccabees 12:6-18, and reminding them of earlier relations between Arius and Onias, even suggesting that the Spartans and Judeans were both of the stock of Abraham and hence kinsmen. After the death of Jonathan, his brother and successor Simon received a reply to this letter in 1 Maccabees 14:20 22. In 1 Maccabees 15:16 22, there is a declaration of friendship between Rome and the Judeans, written by the consul Lucius to Ptolemy, king of Egypt, requesting that kings and nations refrain from fighting against the Judeans. The same letter was also sent to many other neighboring countries, including Sparta, verse 23. While some have doubted the authenticity of these letters in 1 Maccabees, there are many scholars who regard them as genuine. There is no doubt that during the 2nd century BC, such declarations of friendship with the Judeans were made by both Rome and Sparta. End quote. Bishop Dionysius addressed Dorian Greeks at Lacedaemon. Dionysius, Bishop of Corinth, and the epistles which he wrote. And first we must speak of Dionysius, who was appointed bishop of the Church of Corinth and communicated freely of his inspired labors not only to his own people, but also to those in foreign lands, and rendered the greatest service to all in the Catholic epistles which he wrote to the churches. The word Catholic here is used in its original sense of those believing in both the Old and New Testaments. Among these is the one addressed to the Lacedaemonians containing instructions in the Orthodox faith. Again, the word Orthodox, indicating the usual persuasion rather than an opinion regarded as heretical. And an admonition to peace and unity. The one also addressed to the Athenians, exciting them to faith and to the life prescribed by the gospel, which he accuses them of esteeming lightly, as if they had almost apostatized from the faith since the martyrdom of their ruler, Publius, which had taken place during the persecutions of those days. He mentions Quadratus also, stating that he was appointed their bishop after the martyrdom of Publius, and testifying that through his zeal they were brought together again and their faith revived. He records, moreover, that Dionysius the Areopagite, who was converted to the faith by the Apostle Paul, according to the statement in the Acts of the Apostles, first obtained the episcopate of the church at Athens. The Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, 2nd Series, Volume 1, Chapter 23, Eusebius. End quote. As a double witness to this, I will quote from Eusebius' 3rd and 4th centuries A.D., The Church History, a new translation by Paul L. Mayer, pages 158 through 159. Bishop Dionysius of Corinth. As Bishop of Corinth, Dionysius gave inspired service not only to those under him, but also those distant, especially through the general epistles he wrote for the churches. Among these, the letter to the Spartans is Orthodox instruction in peace and unity, while the one to the Athenians is a call to faith and to life in accord with the gospel, for disdaining which he censures them as all but apostates from the word, since Publius, their bishop, was martyred in the persecutions of the time. He relates that after this martyrdom, Quadratus was appointed their bishop, and that through his favor they were reunited and their faith revived. He also states that Dionysius the Areopagite, who was converted by the Apostle Paul, as reported in Acts 17:34, was the first to be appointed Bishop of Athens. Another extant epistle of his to the Nicomedians contests Marcion's heresy in defense of the truth. He also wrote to the church at Gortina, and elsewhere on Crete, congratulating Philip, their bishop, on the courage of the church there, but warning him to guard against the heretics. End quote. You will notice how Mayer translates them Spartans, while the former writer labeled them Lacedaemonians. Whether they are called Dorian Greeks, Lacedaemonians, or Spartans, this branch of the Greeks are all the same people. These last two lessons should give you a new and refreshing appreciation on biblical comprehension. It should also inspire a new admiration for the anointed of Yahweh, the historian Herodotus. Over and above that, one should begin to realize how important some of the books of the Apocrypha are. It's simply amazing how people condemn books and people they have never studied. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 72. Thank you for listening.